Well, hello again, everybody. Welcome to another TFMR podcast. Hey, I've got on the line here my pal Denver Dave Kranzler. Dave, as most everybody knows, fund manager, also the proprietor of the great site Investment Research Dynamics, which, man, if you don't go there every day, if you're not following Dave on Twitter, you're missing out, aren't you, Dave? I mean, geez, how come no? I mean, everybody should be following you on Twitter, shouldn't they?
Well, it depends. Some people might think I'm poisoning their minds.
Well, that's true, too. No, the only poison you spew is all this love of Peyton Manning and the Denver Broncos, my friend. That's the only poison.
Spoken like a true Chiefs fan.
Anyway, I guess it was last week, Dave, already, that you sent me an email and said, hey, we should get together and record something about, you know, what's going on here early this year with China devaluing the yuan as aggressive as they are, and it's killing the Chinese stock market. It's rippling around the world. And anyway, that was last week. Now it's this week, and we're finally getting around to doing it. So let's start there, my friend. The yuan devaluation seemed to have stopped, at least temporarily. I think it's been three or four nights in a row they've held it steady, but whatever offshore yuan is keeps going in the tank. They're running out of physical dollars in China, it sounds like, as Chinese are trying to convert their yuan into dollars of all things. And what is going on? I mean, is this the trend of 2016, do you think?
Well, I mean, just sort of on a macro basis, I've kind of had a theory, and it may be total BS, that I think China, part of their motivation for devaluing the yuan, I mean, to me, the obvious explanation is, oh, well, they want to devalue the yuan to make their exports more competitive. And to me, usually the obvious explanation is the tired explanation.
Yeah.
And I don't think it matters how competitive they make their exports. The reason why their exports are weak is because the European and U.S. economies are going into the tank, and the EU is China's largest export destination. The United States is China's second largest export destination. So if China's exports are dropping, it's because their two largest export destinations aren't importing, right?
Right.
And it gets to a point, especially when you see the wholesale inventories, and I just read a report yesterday from the Cass Freight Index of all places that specifically referenced the fact that retailers are sitting on just a massive load of inventories. Well, that means that retailers aren't buying from wholesalers. Wholesalers aren't importing. So China's not exporting. So in that sense, it doesn't matter how cheap Chinese goods are. If there's no demand for them, they're not going to be exporting them.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
How does making their exports more price competitive help their situation?
Well, they're brainwashed Keynesians. You know, we've got a lot of the Chi-coms over there that have apparently spent too much time in London or in New York, and they've all been brainwashed into thinking that the best thing you can do is devalue your currency. You know, at some point, someone's got to wake up and go, you know, it's not really, in the grand scheme of things, it's not bad to have a strong currency. You know, it shows there's demand for our currency. It gives us the ability to print more of it if we want to, you know, mollify the masses. But again, they're the same kind of Keynesian blindsidedness that we see every place else. And it makes me wonder a little bit about, you know, we all talk about the Chinese playing chess while everybody plays checkers and the 10-year and the 25-year and the 50-year plans and all that kind of stuff. Does any of this kind of call into question in your mind at all, this, you know, this notion that we all hold about the Chinese eventually working with the Russians and others to set up, you know, an alternative currency structure?
Well, I think that's in place, but just to kind of circle back to what I was looking for in terms of a better explanation than just the basic, as you point out, Keynesian gobbledygook, and this goes back to when they started, I guess they started devaluing it in what, like July or August?
It was back in August, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right, August. And I started thinking, you know, I think one of the things they're trying to do is let the air slowly out of the massive bubbles that have developed over there.
Right. Well, and Dave,
I mean, everyone knows bubbles ultimately, when they pop, are more cause more destruction than the good that they did on the way up.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, getting back to this chess and checkers thing, how many times have you heard, do you think, from the traditional media, the Keynesians out there, that the Chinese, with their whatever what used to be $1.1 trillion in U.S. Treasury bonds as part of their foreign currency reserves, that they can't sell those? No. They have to keep those because they know that they'll be shooting themselves in the foot if they do so. I mean, haven't you heard that 1,000 times in the last decade or two decades?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, hold on. Hold that thought. We now know, though, that back in August, in this crisis that was allegedly created by the devaluation of the yuan, they liquidated $100 billion worth of those U.S. Treasury bonds without moving the needle on interest rates. And now there's reports that they've done so again here in the last week of December, early January, without moving the needle. In fact, interest rates are down. I don't know. I mean, am I crazy?
That's a great point. And part of what devaluing the yuan does creates turmoil in the equity markets, and it creates a quote unquote safety bed in U.S. Treasuries that they can sell into.
Exactly.
That's a great point. And I think that kind of ties into part of what I think is going on. Ultimately, there's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of moving parts, but my thinking is if you're a long-term strategic thinker like they are, you want to let the air, you want your bubble to go away before everyone else's does, because when everyone else's bubble blows up, if you've got yours largely washed out, which doesn't mean that you're necessarily in a good economic position, but you put yourself, you've gotten the bad, the painful, distasteful medicine out of the way, which is the popping of the bubble. If everyone's bubble pops at once, it's probably where World War III starts. But if these guys let their bubble out before everyone else does, if they sort of can control it at that, it's somewhat controllable at that point.
That's where we were in 2008.
It's going to put them
in
a better position.
That's where we were in 2008. Everybody's bubble was popping at once. Which, I always thought that's why the Chinese played along in 2008, because they're like, hell, we're all popping at once. But they've used the 7 or 8 years since to say, well, hell, we're not going down that road again. I mean, we're going to have an alternative in place for when this finally does completely blow up.
Right. And part of that is they got to address their bubbles. And, they know their bubbles. Their bubbles, their equity valuations, I guess, on a PE basis are even worse than ours. And then what I started thinking about, you've been real proactive about showing how the dollar yuan relationship correlates with being used as a lever to prop up the U.S. stock market,
or the dollar yen,
right? Yeah. This ties into what I'm getting to, but I just as a backdrop, So the yen is being used as a massive carry trade here, because the yen's got a 0% interest rate, and you sell or short yen and use that money and put it in our stock market, right?
Right.
That's basically one of the carry trades, also into our treasuries, and earn the interest spread. But it's also being used to fund the stock market bubble here, and that's why when the yen goes down versus the dollar, the stock market goes up. One of the reasons.
Right.
Well, guess what? The dollar yen is not the only carry trade that's possible, because interest rates in China are even higher than they are in the U.S. So I can't prove this, but I have to believe that there's been a massive yen yuan or yuan yen carry trade that's been implemented over there.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you short the crap out of yen. And you take that money and you put it into offshore yuan, which are paying a much higher interest rate, or you take that money and you throw it into the Shanghai stock market, which, I think I read an article yesterday that alluded to something like a 60 PE ratio on the Shanghai index. So I think the same type of carry trade with using the yen to finance it that's been going on in this country has also been going on over there.
And now that's being unwound.
And that's being unwound.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I went and this morning, I meant to do this a while ago, I'm getting distracted with other stuff. I went and I looked at a graph of the yen won. And since August, the yen has gone up 14% versus the won, which tells me that when they devalue the won, it forces an unwinding of the yen-won carry trade, right?
Right, right.
Which, you're seeing, because you're long won and you're like, oh shit, I better sell my won and cover my yen short before the Chinese government sells it for me.
Which then does two things. That then drives the Chinese stock market down even further. That unwinding
drives
that
the Chinese
trade.
Stock market down. And then there's cross correlation between the dollar yen.
Right, right, right. It drives the yen higher, which drives the dollar yen lower. That USD JPY, which everybody follows, which has just been crashing now for the last couple of weeks. And then that dollar yen crashing drives the stock market, the U.S. stock market lower.
Exactly, and it's all done with algos. It's all done with black boxes.
Right.
So the guys managing these funds don't even think about it. They just let their computers do the trading. And I looked at the dollar yen. Now for the yen won to be down 14% since August, that's just a massive move. That's incredible.
Yeah.
And for a currency market. But the dollar yen is down over 5.5% since August. And that's a huge move too. A 1% move in currency is big.
Yeah. I think you got it, Dave. That's fantastic, and I haven't seen that anywhere. But that makes all the sense in the world as to why one lever bumps into another, or one domino knocks over another, and we're seeing it play out in real time. I think you've got it.
I mean, it doesn't make sense to me that just because they devalue the yuan, it should cause our stock market to tank.
Yeah, but that does make sense.
Other than it's just all this financial engineering that's gone on, and everyone thinks that the central banks are in control and they'll never lose control, but there's always going to be slippage somewhere. We saw it in 08. There was slippage in the mortgage derivatives, and part of the problem is that the banks lie to the central banks about their position.
Well, yeah, that's right.
And I know they lie to the central banks because the higher-ups at the banks get their information from the lower-downs, people like me when I was at Bankers Trust. And we used to go out of our way to hide bad positions at the end of the year.
Yeah, well, that's what...
So if the Fed or another central bank is implementing some sort of policy, thinking that the banks in its system are set up a certain way, those banks may not actually be financially positioned the way the central bank thinks it is.
Yeah, no, that's right. You know, I tell you what, that leads me, though, to the other thing I want to talk to you about, and that's a high-yield market. Because, man, I think this is, this could very well be the disaster of 2016 that then leads to every other disaster that follows. You know, you mentioned the mortgage market in 2007 and 8, and tell me what you think of this, Dave, based off, your experience. And everybody, I don't know if everybody knows, but you've been a bond trader most of your professional life, right? Okay. I read The Big Short in 2009. It was one of the big reasons why Turd became Turd. It was a real eye-opener. I haven't seen the movie yet, but I understand it's pretty good. And
you got to see the movie. It's fantastic.
The biggest problem, or not, the banks are the banks, and they're going to screw each other, and they're all, out bloodsuckers anyway, right? And the Fed's going to protect them. But they shove this crap down the throats of the average investor, right? And with the problem now is that, the Fed has kept rates at zero for so long that the average retiree, anybody that wants a conservative investment, so many folks own these high yield funds. They're just desperately searching for any kind of yield because rates are so low. Okay, so there's all these high yield funds out there that then are getting inflows that are then looking for product, looking for bonds to buy to stick in their funds, with all these cash flows coming in, these money flows. And so they go out and they buy these crap bonds You know, the banks are all underwriting them and issuing them, and they're all issued on these companies like shale companies and the like that never in a million years should have been selling debt to anybody other than a million-dollar net worth accredited high net worth person. But instead, they're able to float all this garbage out into the regular market. It gets gobbled up by these high-yield bond funds and then thus owned by, you know, your average 67-year-old retiree who's trying to desperately to supplement their Social Security. And now, the economic Mother Nature's coming back ashore, and all these bonds are going to nothing. They can't be liquidated because there's no bid. And now these high-yield funds are beginning to slam the doors. I mean, am I seeing this all right, Dave? Is that a pretty good summary of why we're in such trouble with high yield?
It's a great summary, but there's another there's a bigger component to the high yield side than the individual investor. I mean, for sure, you've got the issue of the guy in his 60s whose financial advisor tells him to buy these high yield funds. They're diversified, blah blah blah.
Right.
Okay, and they're going to get hammered on their investment, and they did it out of desperation for seeking yield to supplement their income. Well, I mean, again, the problem is you should never listen to a financial advisor without doing your homework yourself. And if you did the real research required, you probably wouldn't have invested in these things, even though you were tempted by the yield.
Right.
However, having said that, the component that gets left out of all the articles that get posted about this are the fact that the pension funds are the ones that were really driving the collapse compression in high yield yields.
You're right.
So that's a much bigger component. And pension funds, I mean, I have a friend who works at a pension fund here in Denver, and so I get to see some insight into how these guys make their decision making processes. And in a sense, it's a catch 22 because, and these guys don't even care about fundamentals because they have these models that say how they should allocate. That's how all these pension funds do it. And they allocate it to fund managers. So if their model tells them, well, listen, we need to be allocated 20% in high yield, then they'll go out and they'll find high yield hedge fund managers or high yield funds where they can throw that have institutional sides to the funds where they can put this money into. They don't just evaluate hedge funds; they evaluate
managers,
regular mutual funds that have institutional funds. And so, what happens is because the pension funds they're not going to make their return bogey in order to keep their pension funded, their pension outflows funded, with 1% treasury. So they need to find higher yield. So these pension funds are way over allocated in high yield. And the high yield segment itself has largely become predominantly, even though the ratings don't reflect it, predominantly CCC quality paper. All these oil shale companies, et cetera.
Right.
And historically, when a company has a CCC rating, the default rate is well in excess of 50% or the default probability. And you're seeing this paper in these high yield funds that may even have as high as a double B rating that really 20 years ago would have gotten a CCC designation. And that's the kind of risk that's embedded in the high yield market. And you're right, it is the flood of capital that flooded into these sectors seeking the high yield.
But it's not just the average guys, really, it's pension funds too. You're right.
It's even the pension funds. The pension funds are going to get slaughtered. I know a lot of these pension funds have, 20% plus or minus allocation into private equity. And guess where private equity has been going? Silicon Valley unicorns,
yeah.
energy sector, and also these buy to rent schemes, these big funds that were doing the buying up these distressed homes to rent them out. And we just had a transaction that occurred a couple months ago, where it was the Colony Capital bought out a Starwood fund that was buy-to-rent. And the price that they paid for the Starwood fund valued the houses in the fund at 50% of what Starwood originally paid for the homes.
Oh, God.
That tells you, yeah.
Well, in that regard, that is
so that tells you the bloodbath that's ahead of us in the buy-to-rent real estate sector.
And that is like 2008. And where the high yield thing is like 2008, it gets back to redemptions in that, you know, all these worthless CDOs all went to worthless because there were no buyers. You got to have buyers to have a market in these things. And they, you know, their underlying securities were bad and the mortgages were bad and they went to pennies on the dollar. And again, if someone's in a, like these pension funds want to liquidate money out of their high yield manager, or if the average retiree wants to get out of their high yield fund, they try to liquidate. They put in a sell order. That manager then has to sell bonds to raise cash to meet the redemption. And if they're in there trying to sell in an illiquid market where there are no buyers, there are no bids, prices just begin this kind of cascade down, almost like what we used to see in the metals all the time.
That's right. It's a complete negative feedback cycle. And what's amazing, and it's amazing how little publicity it gets, but and this goes back to when I was trading the high yield market in the 90s, the flows in the high yield market always precede or always foreshadow what's going to happen in the market at large. So during the 90s, you had the series, you had the Russian ruble crisis, you had the Mexican peso crisis, you had the emerging market crisis, you had long-term capital. And every time before those crises hit, miraculously, like maybe a month ahead before the actual news came out of what was going on, all of a sudden you'd see outflows out of the high yield market, and the high yield market would go, bids would just disappear. So because the same the dynamic that you're describing, there's outflows, managers go to sell paper, all of a sudden the bids are gone because no one's buying, and all of a sudden the market gaps down. And what happens is it's a negative feedback cycle, and then it affects the investment grade market because complexes that can't sell high yield, their high yield paper, all of a sudden look to sell their investment grade. And then the investment grade spreads widen out, which is what we're seeing. Yeah. It's happened over and over again. It happened in 08. I mean, high yield started blowing up before the real news on what was going on in the market hit the tape.
Yeah.
And it always precedes a stock market accident. So, I mean, there's no question the Fed is behind the scenes trying to hold this up as well as they can, but I have no doubt that what we've seen go on in the high yield market, and it was triggered by the energy sector, but that's not the only problem with the high yield market. I have no doubt that at some point we're just seeing a small taste of what's coming in the stock market.
Yeah.
You can't blame that on China. I'm sorry.
they'll try to. You know, got to have a boogeyman.
Exactly.
I've talked about that a lot on my site, and folks listening know. You know, we've talked about the death candle in the S&P back in August before the market really even started to tip over, and it's all laying out, you know, exactly as it did in 2001 and 2000. I mean, it's eerie. And so there's really no doubt left. The stock market's going down. The bond market is a mess. I mean, and there's these notes now. You see them. I'm sure you've seen them, Dave, on Zero Hedge. Some bank, you know, or some sell side guy saying, you know, get out of everything. I think at this point, the safe move is to get out of everything. That's probably going to continue. It'll be interesting though to see. And I just the last thing I want to talk to you about is gold. It'll be interesting to see how this impacts gold. I mean, obviously, you and I could sit here and talk all day. But I doubt folks listening to us have time to listen all day. So for that last topic,
let's talk about... You might not want to listen to us at all, Craig.
Well, that's true too. For anybody still listening, we'll wrap up with, let's talk about gold and we'll call it a day for now.
Sure.
You know, we've had a nice bounce, nice rally. We put in a nice kind of rounded double bottom at 1050 below 1080. All these different things that I think make us optimistic that, you know, this last 3 or 4 year run, a kind of counterintuitive bear market within a bull market, whatever you want to call it, may finally be coming to an end. But you also have been telling me a little bit about some of the stuff you're seeing kind of beneath the surface on the physical side, some stuff that you're kind of connecting some dots about physical and London and where the LBMA may be getting gold to ship to China and Russia on a monthly basis. Maybe that physical market will start to kind of dominate things in 2016 too. What can you tell everybody about your thoughts there?
Well, I mean, I'm just kind of taking information that I pull from all over the place about what's going on in the physical market, because as you know, and as your listeners know, no one can figure out where all this gold is coming from that's being delivered into India and China and even Russia. I ran some numbers when I put together our year-end, quarterly-end investor letter, and I kind of estimated that China, Russia, and India combined imported about 3,500 tons of gold during 2015. And the number for India wouldn't include Dore bar imports, which India started, it actually became somewhat well known that importers in India started importing Dore bars because they're not taxed as highly. There's not as high an import duty on Dore bars as there is on LBMA bars. And also, there's still a lot of smuggling into India.
Yep.
And there's no way to account for that. So if you just take, India essentially imported about 1,000 tons. It looks like China, based on withdrawals from the SGE, probably imported around 2,300 tons. And then it looked like, I guess, Russia might have accounted for, I can't remember what my number was, somewhere between 300 and 500 tons.
Something like
that. So essentially call 3,500. And if you say, okay, well, and again, we won't even know this number probably for another year, I guess, the way they lag the data. But I think, in general, there's about 2,500 tons of gold produced by mines. So you got a thousand ton deficit. So where's all this gold coming from? And there's a guy, you know of him, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with him, a guy named Dave Jensen, who's done a lot of work on it, and he kind of figures that the vaults in London have largely been tapped out. So if there's not, so in other words, a lot of the above ground vaulted gold that's been used and through hypothecation and leasing is largely been tapped out.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's like, okay, well, where's this gold come from? And he and I kind of independently had decided during the course of 2015 that the big banks like JP Morgan have probably contracted with the big gold mining companies to take their Dore bar and ship it directly to refineries in Switzerland in order to make deliveries into China.
Go around London completely.
It goes around London completely. And again, this is all circumstantial. There's no way to prove this. No one could prove it because we just the market's so opaque.
Right.
However, we have heard guys like James Turk and Andrew McGuire and Alistair McLeod talk about the fact that a lot of gold now is being circumvented around the LBMA. In other words, the LBMA is not the physical market that it used to be, so that a lot of the gold that ends up getting sent to the Eastern Hemisphere buyers is not even going through the LBMA. And that's where I think it makes sense that that banks like JP Morgan and HSBC have just gone to the big gold miners and said, hey, we're buying your future production, and anything you produce, we want you to take the Dore bars and send them to these refineries in Switzerland. And I think that's probably what's going on.
You know, and
that's probably where the gold's coming from. But at some point, that there's going to be a big enough of a shortfall in physical demand versus what's available to deliver into the physical buyers that it's going to start to put upward pressure on the paper market. And that may be what we're seeing now. I don't know. It'll take some time to play out to see if that's right.
Dude, we've talked about that. Anybody listening on my side knows we've talked about that now for 3 years. There's a line I've drawn ever since, we had that brutal smash through 1525 back in April of 2015. Remember the $200 in 2 days, and the hundreds and hundreds of paper, tons of paper gold that were thrown at, to take out that 1525 low that it held for 19 months. Came down to a low of 1320. And the wee hours, I think, of the 15th or the 16th of April that year, and then bounced for a couple of weeks. And I'm about the only person that follows this line. I call it the nemesis line. If you make a trend line off of that peak and then just connect it down to the next peak and on, you can clearly see a series of lower highs that has been really brutally enforced. And we, you know, you and I have talked about these banks just, even at these price levels, just issuing all these naked shorts, trying to blunt momentum and try to keep price from breaking through and upward through moving averages. We saw it in October, the cap that was put at the 200-day moving average in October before they were able to smash it back down. And yes. I've contended, Dave, and so what I'm getting at is this, what you just described about the physical flow. I've contended that all of this in this brutal downtrend, that, you know, the disconnect from everybody's seen those charts, you know, of Federal Reserve balance sheet and U.S. government debt and the gold price all going up in tandem until 2012, when all of a sudden gold goes straight down while everything else keeps going up. I've contended that's all about controlling price, for the main intent being to control sentiment. You know, by smashing price, they've driven sentiment down so far that you had, what is it, 700 metric tons of gold leave the GLD, you know, allegedly.
Yes.
And if you can keep price going down, then you can keep Western sentiment down. And if you can keep Western sentiment down, then you can keep Western physical demand down. Because what you've just described, if they're living off a flow, as we suspect, to meet Eastern demand, well, what in the hell are they going to do when Western demand comes back? Then where's the gold going to come from? And maybe that's the final stake in their heart, Dave. Maybe that's what they're so desperately fighting against.
I think it's two prongs. It's the sentiment, like you say, but I mean, think about it. If they, let's just say they said, oh, we're not worried about the price of gold. We'll let the price do whatever it wants. If the price of gold were allowed to embark on unfettered price seeking and shot up, all of a sudden, I think there's a big body of people out there who are aware that you know, the government reports phony economic numbers, and they're aware of the fact that the economy is tanking. But I think they also have hope that that's not really happening, and so they cling on to any nugget or any sign that people like you and I, what we say isn't true. And if the price of gold were to be allowed to rise to its natural trading level, it would confirm everything that we've been saying, and they couldn't deny it. It would take away all that hope. And I think that's part of, that's the sort of the sentiment or psychological side. And then, yeah, the practical side is they got to do whatever they can to try and derail any interest in people in the West from buying gold. Because you're right, at the margin, if even just 1 or 2% more of the population here takes their cash and converts it into physical gold, I think you'll start to see huge defaults, and you probably even see that the COMEX fail very quickly.
Yeah, and LBMA too, you know, and all these central banks that, like Switzerland, claims they have 1,041 metric tons of gold. They have 1,041 metric tons of paper certificates. That's all they have.
Exactly.
I mean, the whole thing is at a tipping point, but we've been at a tipping point for a while. But I guess I don't even mean to wrap up this way, and I didn't intend, this wasn't the point of this, of you and I talking and recording this call, but I'm now going to go to this, and we'll just end here. I mean, you've described how it is that China is devaluing their yuan and how that impacts the yen most likely, and why that is then impacting our stock market, not only the Chinese stock market. How that will likely be a continuing trend, maybe even because the Chinese want it that way so that they can always have a bid for their bonds or U.S. treasuries that they'd like to get out from under. Then we talk about the high yield market and what a just looming disaster that is, combined with the U.S. stock market. All of these things conspiring for a really nasty, volatile 2016, which may finally be enough to re-energize Western investment demand for gold. And then that final piece of puzzle that you provided, if big miners like Barrick are already completely tapped out of future supply because it's already been sold forward by, you know, banks like JP Morgan to meet current demand, well, then hell's bells. Maybe this isn't going to be the year where it all falls apart, Dave.
I'm just
speechless.
Every year at the beginning of the year, it's like I wonder how they can keep the system together. And I think we're finally seeing enough signs this year that suggest that, again, they always surprise me with some sort of new rabbit they pull out of the hat. But I think all the rabbits have been used up.
Yeah. I tell you what, Dave, if this all starts to go like this, this trend all continues, I'm just going to point my car west on I-70, and I'm going to pick you up. We'll get a big bag of weed from one of those head shops in Denver, and we'll just go up.
Go down to Mexico.
We'll just call it a day. We'll get a big bag of Doritos. And
go to Vegas first.
Yeah, well, there you go. Actually, after we smoke all the weed out there on Pikes Peak, then we'll just drive on to Vegas and go. Oh man, it's going to be a wild one. It's going to be. I mean, again, anybody listening to us here in middle part of January, I mean, you could clearly see where all of these dominoes are already beginning to tumble. Now, like you said, I mean, every year you think, hell, I'd have thought in 2010 we're never going to, you know, the system's never going to hold to 2011. Obviously, some dramatic actions have been taken, not only in the gold and silver markets, but by central banks to keep everything together. But damn, if it doesn't seem like it's all kind of getting towards the last legs. I mean, we'll see. We shall see. Well, I tell you what, my friend, you know, as I said at the beginning, the work you do is fantastic. You've been all over, you know, what a scam like Amazon is, you know, that type of thing. I mean, your interest is more diverse than just the metals, which is why I recommend everybody read your site and follow you on Twitter and all that kind of jazz. Anything else you want to say before we call today?
Thanks a lot, Craig. I really appreciate that. And likewise, back to you. I mean, you're doing phenomenal work with your, especially with your technical analysis.
Oh, gee.
And the charts that you post on Twitter. I mean, those are, I learn something every time you post a chart on Twitter.
Oh, gosh.
I just wanted to mention really, really quickly in conjunction with my website, I rolled out what I call a short seller's journal in early December. And it's actually doing a little better than I had built into my expectations. And essentially what it is a weekly report that's delivered to your email. And it's a monthly subscription basis. And I come up with a couple of short sell ideas every week. And in general, they're meant to be longer term, short this stock and hold it for 12 months and you should make a lot of money on it unless they figure out another way to rig the stock market higher. And I also come up with, and it depends on the specific trading on any specific week, what I call a quick hit idea. So like last week I had picked out Weight Watchers as a quick hit idea. And I suggested a put option, a 1 week put option to play. This one did way better than I would have expected. I was looking for an easy couple points to the downside in Weight Watchers. The stock itself dropped 34% last week, and the put option went up 600%.
Well, that'll work.
And that's if you managed to get the short off or buy the put first thing last Monday, and you held the put until right before expiration. But, I mean, even if you only caught part of that move, I mean, it would have more than paid for the subscription for more than a year.
Well, that is very cool. I apologize for not mentioning that before. I had seen your stuff
Short Seller
Journal, and I hadn't had a chance to check it out. That's awesome, and fits right in line with. I mean, if anybody hears, you know, thinks it's logical what we've been talking about for the past 38 minutes, and they think they'd like to make some fiat that then they can cash in and buy more physical metal, that certainly seems like a logical service to pick up.
And actually, I will be suggesting some junior mining shares once in a while. I call those, it's the same thing as shorting the market in the sense that precious metals are a contra stock market play.
Yeah.
Event, you know, ultimately metals and miners move inversely to the stock market. And last week I had a fairly brand new junior silver mining. It's an exploration company. It's highly speculative, but it's also trades under 20 cents. So one of those ones you buy a little and it might be better than playing the Powerball.
I was going to say,
in terms of your odds of making money.
Like that Vegas thing we just talked about. You're right.
Exactly.
Well, again, where do people find out info on that, Dave?
It's right on my blog, okay. investmentresearchdynamics.com.
All right. Well, pal, thanks. Sure, always good to talk to you. I wish you best of luck this weekend with Ben Roethlisberger coming to town. Is the weather going to be good out there?
you know how Denver is. Right now the forecast is for mid-40s, which is fine for Peyton Manning, but I don't trust any forecast that's more than out a day in Denver. I mean, they're forecasting 40s for the rest of the week. We actually got close to 60 yesterday. But the problem is we could wake up Sunday morning to a blizzard, so who knows?
Yeah. Do they let Peyton, does he get to use any kind of, like, aid, like a walker or anything like that in the pocket? Or...
No, but when he goes out to midfield for the coin toss, he's in a wheelchair.
He's got like those guys you see at the casino with like the oxygen tank next to him, you know, and stuff.
Yeah.
Peyton Manning is not my favorite. That didn't even work, but I love those commercials.
I'm so tired of that ad. I put the TV on mute when that nationwide ad comes on. Well, and I would like to say good luck to the Chiefs this weekend, but if Denver wins, I'd rather play the Patriots than the Chiefs the following week.
If they do, Dave, offline, we may have to cook up a little wager. We'll have to see.
There you go.
Well, and you know what? We'll do this again sometime. I have a sneaky feeling that much of what we've discussed is going to be playing out in the days ahead, so... for everybody listening, maybe we can do this again sometime soon. Just this kind of informal discussion, because I would imagine folks that have listened have enjoyed it.
Sounds great to me. Anytime you want to chat, I love chatting with you.
All right, my friend. Have a great rest of your day, and keep the faith.
Thanks. You too.